Life itself is an initiation process. Life itself will try and kill you, slap you in the head enough to wake you up and put you on a different course. You're always going to need to be leveling up. If you just fix your problems, you'll fix the world around you. Kids need to have an outlet to be able to express whatever it is they're saying. And people don't want to let go of that version of them that they've identified with so strongly because it feels like family. It feels like who they really are. It's part of them.
All right. Welcome to the Rad Dad Podcast. This is episode 26. I have my friend Nilsen Whiting on. Nilsen and I have known each other a very long time.
It's been a while.
Probably over like 25 years, but yeah.
How old are you now?
I'm 31.
Oh yeah. So I've a long known time. You since you were born almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess you could say family friends as well. So just to get started into the podcast, talk to me about your upbringing and like a few highlights from your childhood.
Oh, highlights from my childhood, my upbringing. Yeah, so I just grew up right here in Mapleton, right next to your house.
Yep.
Down there. So I'd come over and throw rocks around, go in your barn and catch cats with your brother.
Yep.
Yeah. But yeah, we just, you know, normal life. It was kind of nice living out there because we could run around anywhere. I feel like I had a super idyllic childhood because we were there and then we moved over to Mapleton and my grandpa's field was right behind us on 36 acres. And in the far corner away from all of the houses was our little hut, right? Mm-hmm. So we just spent all of our spare time out there. And my kids now, they always ask me about my childhood. And they're like, I wish I lived when you lived, because now they're in like, you know, a concrete jungle. All the houses yeah. right next to each other.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really awesome. We just played a ton. Then the summer, my parents got divorced when I was 12. And my two younger siblings went with my mom and lived up in Oregon on where that's where she grew up. And my grandpa lives up there still on a huge ranch, thousands and thousands of acres of farmland, cattle ranch. And so every summer we'd go up there and just work our butts off.
Yeah.
All summer driving cattle.
I did not know that.
It's one of those things that, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, that sounds awesome. And you're like 8 hours a day with my, you know, getting saddle sore and all of the hair getting rubbed off your legs in the dust and in the sun and just smelling cows that are all crapping in front of you, you know, all day long. It, you know, as a kid, I was like, I think I can find something funner to do, but you got to help. You get up and we were always living by the code of the West. My grandpa, code of the West, you get up at the crack of dawn. If you don't get up before the sun gets up, you're going to have a headache all day. That's what he'd say. Anyway, he's like 85 and still working like crazy harder than anyone else.
Huh.
So
I guess I kind of let you know from a young age, like, yeah, this is probably not what I want to do with my life. Right.
Right. Well, and I've asked him since. I was like, hey, what does it take to build a business out of a ranch? And he's just like, don't do that. It's a lot of work and not as much money as you'd think.
Yeah.
In it, you know,
I saw a study the other day online and they interviewed like thousands of different occupations, about their happiness and mood levels. And the happiest people were farmers.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I found that kind of interesting and they're a dying breed, but like you said, he's 85, like that generation that man, they're just tough and they just work and
Well, I wonder if some of that has to do with doing what man was meant to do. You know, Adam's cast out of the Garden of Eden and the first two jobs, tiller of the field and the keeper of the flocks.
Yeah.
Right? Those are the two things. And in fact, in the garden, those are the first two things that Adam was told to do. Here, keep and dress this garden and go name the animals, right? So he has responsibility over gardening and animals. And maybe that's just part of how it's supposed to be, you know?
You're probably right. Yeah. Are there any attributes or traits that your dad has that you noticed from a young age where you said, that's how I want to be as a dad?
Yeah. The one thing that I always notice, and I feel like I don't have very many memories of my childhood for some reason.
I'm the same way.
Back there.
Yeah.
I have my theories as to why that is, you know, because I'm a hypnotherapist and I do a lot of this mind work and memory recall work on other people. I do remember he was always available when I wanted to talk to him. Always. he was always available. You know, I was a big tennis player growing up, but yep. he played in college at Utah State, and he wanted to foster that in us. His mom was big on making sure that all the grandkids served a mission and played a sport and went to BYU and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't meet all of her criteria, but, and Eagle Scouts had to do all of it. But he was always there if I wanted to play tennis. And from a young age, he's like, if you ever want to go play, you just tell me. If you want to go play in a tournament, you tell me. And so not only would he go and practice with me all the time, but I just felt like he was very approachable and very available. And part of that was just the nature of his job. So he was in the military, but he was never active duty in, you know, off fighting somewhere. He was active duty, but he always seemed to be stationed close to home and somewhere where he could be with us. And then his other job with the military, his day job was real estate. And, you know, you can set your own hours doing that. Mm-hmm. He was always creative enough to set the schedule and make it work and bring in the income. And I never had to question anything about money. Like I didn't have to understand it. I didn't have to worry about whether it was a thing. And I know a lot of dads are always talking about money problems and kids kind of get all fixated on that at a young age. And I never had that. And I don't think we necessarily lived like kings and queens, but he always provided for us, for one. Then he was always there, which I felt like was awesome. And I'm always, every time I think of working an 8-hour day over and over and over again, I'm like, yeah, this is nice for me to feel like I'm getting work done, but I want my kids to be able to come in and interrupt my work and ask me if they have, or talk to me if they have an issue.
Yeah.
You know, or like, hey dad, let's go play tennis. And I want to be able to drop everything and go play with them.
Yeah. No, that was my next question is, have you applied that in fatherhood in your experience?
Well, yeah, I've certainly tried to. So there are some occupations where you just can't do that.
Yep.
If you rope yourself into working for somebody else. And my dad always said, one of the things that he did say was avoid employees like the plague that they are. And the only time I was ever an employee was when I was working as a seminary teacher for the church down at Payson Junior High. And I was still going to school and we had a new baby and it was just, you know, no time for anything.
So he's saying to avoid being an employee to someone.
Well, that was one of the things that I picked up from my dad, not to go work for anyone else. Cause I never had a job working for somebody else. I was always able to run my own show.
Yeah.
I was kind of a lone wolf that way. And even when we tried to build a real estate team together and we were hiring more people as a team and they were almost like employees, even though they're all general contractors, it was just like babysitting. And yeah. I was like, yeah, I don't really want to do that. But yeah, that was, so when I was doing seminary, I didn't really have time to do that. But then I got into real estate and I was able to work, you know, almost like 4 or 5 hour days and feel pretty good about what I was doing, as far as still being able to make the money. And then, last 4 years, just working hard in what I'm doing now, I've been able to craft my own business and build it. I'm taking a lot of, what some people might consider risk as far as my business model. But it makes it so that I have flexibility.
Gotcha.
And I can still put food on the table.
So where you're at now, do you feel like that's always been kind of the end goal, to have that freedom and you've built your life around that, or you're there now and you're like, okay, this is what I've always wanted, and you're just now realizing that?
Yeah, that's a good point, because I was in real estate, still am. And we just put an offer on a house yesterday. And so there's still stuff that I'm doing in real estate. But for the last 4 years, building my hypnotherapy business, the reason I really pushed to get out of real estate and into hypnotherapy was because I was really intrigued with the power of the mind and how I could go out and heal people and help people in a way that's super meaningful. I mean, talk about a job where you're out just relieving suffering. I feel like that's what I'm doing all day long, which is awesome. Let's see. What was your question? Oh yeah. Crafting the job. So I think that there's kind of a balance, because you want to be able to be there for your kids. But one of the things that you want to also show your kids is by example, how to not just work hard, but the fact that you are doing something that is meaningful to you and you feel like is kind of a calling for you, and you show them what that looks like. And I've seen, you know, fathers who really pushed that to the extreme where it was unhealthy, and they were such workaholics pursuing their dream that they neglected their kids. And I think, unfortunately, you know, with the religious background that we grew up in, I think that can happen easy if you get stuck in like a calling and you're just doing all of this and it's the calling and you're neglecting your kids because you're spending so much time, or the spouse feels neglected. Yeah, right. Yeah. I think it's easy to get stuck in that. But the other side of that is, I think you do need to show your kids that you've got a dream that you're pursuing and show them what it looks like, hard work to achieve that. And so is it the ideal? No, I don't think it's quite the ideal yet, but you know, we're crafting it. We're putting it together.
You're in the process.
Though. Yeah.
That's awesome. I read a quote the other day that was like, it said something like, the only people that are going to remember your late nights worked 20 years from now are your kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's an interesting statement. My wife doesn't let me work nights. when I was in real estate, you had to work nights and weekends and whenever you didn't want to have call. To, right?
Yeah.
Fortunately, with my hypnotherapy business, I don't have to do that. So my wife knows when I'm done, I can set the cell phone aside.
Yeah.
Very unlike real estate. And that feels so good to be able to do that. But yeah, late nights, your kids, yeah, you can't put them to bed. You can't read them the bedtime story. You can't, you know, share your day with them, share your wins and talk to them when it matters to them. I feel like kids wake up right before bedtime and all they want to do is talk and connect with you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, I need to reserve this time, because when they're done with school, well, how's school? I want to go do something else. Yeah. I want to go play. I don't want to connect with you right now. I want to go because I've been working all day and then I've been working all day. Mm-hmm. And so at night, right before bed, they wake up and they have all the energy to visit.
I really like what you said about having this purpose and you feel like you're healing people. That's really a big reason I started this podcast, because I was like, taking a look at my life and I'm like, what is my purpose? Because I don't feel like I really make a significant difference in other people's lives through my work. You know, I do marketing and I do video and photo content. I'm not changing lives, mm-hmm. you know? And, this podcast was partly inspired, because of those thoughts. And I just felt like I needed a purpose beyond work and what I was doing. And, it was inspired to talk about, you know, the trials and triumphs of being a dad and men's mental health. Yeah. Talk to me, how does it feel to wake up every morning and know you're making a difference?
That feels really good. I mean, it's one of the things where somebody's happy to go give you a 5-star review on Google. Mm-hmm. You know, that's nice, and it's nice for the business, but it feels even better when they're, you know, they've been stuck in all these kinds of addictions and depression, anxiety and fears and chronic illnesses, and you're able to fix that faster than, you know, all the other therapies that they've tried or medications and doctors and all the different modalities. Fortunately, I've been able to find a way to do that. But I think that, you know, to get maybe philosophical or ideological on the whole idea, you know, if you kind of let me ramble for a second,
there's a
concept that I know you're familiar with because I went through it with your dad, and it's the process of initiation, initiating a boy into manhood, right? And, you know, puberty will do that. But if you look at all of the ancient civilizations and cultures and, basically everything that we have the earliest records of, all of them seem to agree on these highest and holiest teachings. And it's this concept of ascension or transcendence into, it's beyond even transhumanism. It's connection with the divine kind of a thing. But they all had a process of getting there called initiation, and it'll naturally happen, for boys at puberty, but not as natural as for girls at puberty, right? They immediately become a woman, whether they want to or not. And they go through all the phases of initiation through that process at 12, 13 years old. A little boy though, he goes through puberty, but it's a different process. And the reason I'm even bringing this up is because you have to go through initiation to find your purpose. You have to go through initiation to find your meaning, because one of the things that you're supposed to learn through the process of initiation is life is hard. And every choice that you make has a consequence. sometimes dire, serious, tragic consequences, yeah. you know? And that there's a process to leveling yourself up all the time. But every time you level yourself up, you kill off the boy psychology, you kill off the old version of you, and you find a new purpose. Just, you know, as an example or as a pattern, you have lots and lots of stories of this, but I'll give the one that I went through with your dad, right? He took us down to Escalante and we did our survival week down there with all the scouts, mm-hmm. all of us 12-year-old boys. And we think this is just going to be some fun hike and we go down there. And it was, but it's actually part of the process of initiation. It goes through the very first thing is isolation. When you become older, you do it on your own. But as a kid, the first process of initiation is to put you outside of your family. You separate in a group with other boys, and then you they take you into the ritual hut. And in that hut, you have a wise man there who teaches you kind of a new vocabulary, secrets of how the village and the community really works, things that you didn't care about before, but you have to care about now because this whole initiation thing is going to turn you into a man, right? And in that hut, this is like, you go in there and it's like, it's like going into the womb, going into the darkness, going into the jungle, into the forest, into the wilderness. You go into this place, kind of like the Native American sweat lodge. It's all very symbolic and every culture had their way of doing this, right?
Yeah.
Some of these like Sioux Indians, maybe they'd actually dig a trench and they'd lay you down in it and cover you in leaves, or you go into this dark hut, or you actually go out into the jungle, right? And they'll just leave you there. And this is what happened when your dad took us out there. You know, did you do that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he takes you out there.
I've heard the stories from your group too.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, for whoever is listening, it was awesome. Cause we went out there and yeah, he's teaching us how to hike and how to orienteer and how to build fires and how to cook together and how to work together as a team. But more than that, you know, you have that night where you got to go sleep on your own.
Yep.
And so you're sleeping on the river and he has everyone sleeping far enough away from each other where you're scared, you know, you're out there and you're like, maybe I've slept on my own before, but not out in the woods.
Yeah.
Not where I can't see anyone, not where if I screamed and yelled really loud, maybe someone would hear me, but maybe not because I'm right next to the river and it's loud, right? And so what actually happened to me was we were, I think I was about the furthest away from the main camp and, I'm in my little mummy bag and I'm sleeping on this sandbar that's right next to the river and right up against this cliffside. And I'm cracking all these glow sticks. So I'm not like afraid in the middle of the night and crack them all and like hang them all around me. And I see all these pack rats are all staring at me. And in the middle of the night, in my sleep, I rolled into the river.
Nope.
I rolled and it was a 5-foot drop about, and I just rolled and fell right into the river. And it was about that deep. And I don't know what it was about being out there on my own, but I didn't wake up. I kind of woke up and I was dreaming that I was on a night hike. And so I like pulled up my sleeping bag and I continued to hike across. And I remember very clearly that I was on this night hike. And I hiked across the river in my sleeping bag and I'm crawling up the other side. And that's when I woke up and I was like, what is going on? I look back, I'm trying to find what the heck is going on. And I find my camp. Well, there's all the glow sticks. Okay, so I go back there, but now everything's soaked. And this isn't the kind of thing where, okay, I can just call for help. It's middle of the night, it's kind of cold,
yeah.
And all of my stuff is wet. And so, you know, changing everything out. Now I don't have a sleeping bag. And so I'm like sitting there with this poncho around me and I fall asleep again. And then I found myself, so it was the sandbar, the river, the cliffside, and then there was a hill that went all the way up. And it was probably 75 feet high. And I woke up on top of that hill. I had slept walked again. And I'm on top of this hill in my bare feet, crawling up this thing, wondering, what the heck am I doing, you know? And so I couldn't sleep the whole rest of the night, but I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, this is what it's like to figure it out, I guess, be on your own and do what you said you're going to do and not go back to camp yeah. no matter what, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and then we go back to camp and found out that, you know, half the camp, half of the other boys had gone back to the camp in the middle of the night because you know, ants are crawling all over them, or pack rats are crawling all over them, or they got scared. So they all went back to camp. And I was like, oh, well, I probably should have gone back to camp too. Well, I didn't know that was an option. But yeah, that's part of the initiation, is you go out in the woods and you're learning what it's like to have to connect with something other than somebody who you can just ask for help for down here in this, you know, this human realm. The other parts of the initiation rites, though, that help you find your purpose is, you know, you get a new name. It's like being born. You get your new name, you get your new family, maybe you get a blessing, you're clothed in some special clothes or whatever. And with every initiation, that is what happens. But the whole purpose of that, it's a symbol of death and resurrection. You put off the old life and you find a new purpose. And part of that, I think, is throughout life, if you don't go through that initiation process, you will, and this is something that is pertinent because I try and teach my boys this, and this is what I feel like it is to be a man and to be a father,
yeah,
is this process, that life itself is an initiation process. Life itself will try and kill you, slap you in the head enough to wake you up and put you on a different course. You know, the Hindus call this the dharmic path. You wander off it and karma hits you in the head with a snowball to get you back on track. But you ignore that enough and then bad things happen. But you can either learn from other people and learn through their initiation processes, or life will do it for you and you kind of fight against it and you resist it the whole time. Or you can put yourself through a voluntary suffering, as it were, recognizing that the suffering is going to teach you what your life is supposed to look like, right? So in that sense, you have kind of a series of initiations that you can put yourself through, by going and connecting. And the idea was not to connect with yourself or to connect with people. You know, in that hut, for example, it has this domed roof. And one of the processes of initiation for a lot of these villages was they'd shatter the roof, or they'd break it. And what that was they'd poke a hole in the top, and that represented connection to heaven. Now, by going into this space like a temple, just by being in that space, you're going to communicate with something transcendent, right? Something divine. And that eye of the dome, the single eye, you know, we got that on our dollar bill, the all-seeing eye on the top of the pyramid looking down. But that's the whole idea, is to connect with that, because the reality is we're not individually like the center of the universe or something more intelligent out there. You connect with it. It cares about you. It has your best interest at heart, and it wants to guide you through this whole process. And if you don't connect to that, then, you know, that's what these traditions call the profane or the degenerate. And it's a degeneration of what man and fatherhood really is into, you know, in our day-to-day, we might call it like the rat race or something, just getting stuck in Babylon, the world and all that. Anyway, there's my rambling for you.
It's awesome. I love it. So you're saying life is, it's not this destination. Like, you don't go through one of these initiations and you don't get to the final one. You're like, I'm done. I'm 75 years old. I've done everything I need. You're saying there's always going to be something else.
Yeah.
Another initiation, another death and rebirth.
Yeah. Well, you're always going to need to be leveling up. You know, for those of us that have kind of the religious background, it's that idea that knowledge saves you, and every initiation is coming to a new sense. We're gaining knowledge of what your identity is. That's why when you're going through initiation, you take on a new name, and that might not literally be, okay, now Jace, you have a different name. Your name's Jack. You know, it's not that. It's a new identity. And this is actually the same exact process I take people through in hypnotherapy every single time we do a session. It's that process of, okay, let's disconnect you from the external world, go inside, and you dive deep into that subconscious so that you can connect to the past, find out what happened in that past that is keeping you stuck in that identity that you're seeing me for. That's the problem, right? You're seeing me because you have this problem. You've connected too heavily with this belief system that's keeping you stuck in whatever that is. And part of this initiation process is the same thing that happens when I take people down. We do age regressions. We go back into the memories. We find out what was keeping them stuck. And then that's when the real battle happens. Well, now what do you want? Well, I want this over here. You know, maybe it's, you know, I want to be successful, but I know that if I'm successful, then that means I have to take on more responsibility. So now down deep, you go and find out, where did you pick up that false idea in the first place? Because that's holding you back, right? And then you got to do battle with that. And maybe it seems easy to do that battle, but for most people, it's not. And sometimes when you connect with that and you find the paradox that you've been fighting against, it kind of comes out in like nuclear proportions. You know, the emotions come out and you're like, oh my gosh. And people don't want to let go of that version of them that they've identified with so strongly, because it feels like family. It feels like who they really are. It's part of them. And if they get rid of that, then what are they going to be instead? And that's where you want them to get, because that vulnerable position is exactly where they start to learn things. And as long as they're able to give up that older version of them and step out of that, now they face new things, but they allow themselves to find the new identity. And it's killing off the old psychology. And every single time, it'll give them a new purpose. Every single time. And it motivates the heck out of people to find that they don't have to identify with that old thing. And we don't even know what the new thing is, but we can explore it now. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Interesting. Take me through how you discovered hypnotherapy and then the point where you decided this is what I'm going to pursue.
Yeah. So when I was 18 years old in high school, I was taking my anatomy class and I was like, there's got to be a better way. And my cousin told me about a book called Double Your Brain Power. And so I'm in high school and I read this book and it taught me this method called getting into the optimum learning state, or the OLS. It's the alpha learning state. And in that state, it'd take about 5 minutes, this little breathing and affirmations exercise. And you take the 5 minutes to do it. And then you absorb whatever it is in the textbook, you know, that you wanted to do. I figured that out and it made it so that I almost didn't have to study at all for any of my anatomy tests. And I aced them, every one of them. And all the smart kids I'm sitting around, they're like, oh, Nelson, well, how is he doing this? You know, he's the dumb one. How is he doing this? You know? And that was cool.
That's crazy that you did that at 18 years old.
Yeah. And I didn't realize that I was putting myself into hypnosis. Yeah. I was doing self-hypnosis, the same kind of thing I still use today.
Yeah.
And so that was 18, 19 years ago that I was using that. And at our senior all-nighter party, a hypnotist came for entertainment purposes. And so I was like, oh, that's really intriguing. I did not connect the two ideas, the exercise I was doing and what this guy was doing, but I was like, this is really intriguing what he's talking about. I want to participate. So I go up on stage, I'm sitting in this row of 40 people and he's starting to take us up in this cloud, you know, in our minds. And I'm in my imagination just relaxing like crazy. And he's like, okay, hit zero. And I just slumped out of my chair and I fell out of my chair head first, and I slammed my head into the stage so hard that I felt like it echoed, and I just heard everyone go, and I hit my head so hard. I thought that should really hurt, and it didn't hurt at all. And there was never a mark. There was never a headache. There was never a goose egg or anything after that. And I understand why now. You put your body into full body anesthesia when you drop into the hypnotic coma. It's what we teach women for painless childbirth. Orgasmic childbirth, even. You get into that state and amazing things happen. But I didn't realize I dropped all the way down in that state. It may have been because I was already doing these exercises, you know. Mm-hmm. But I fell and boom, hit that. And I'm laying there in this hypnotic coma wondering, what is this? This is the strangest, craziest, weirdest, most surreal feeling. And I didn't know what was going on. And I kind of forgot about it until I got back off my mission and then I was using it in tennis. So then after my mission, when I was playing tennis up at Weber State, I was making recordings for myself. I'd record my personal constitution and I'd listen to that and put myself down in the state and listen to that. And I still didn't know this stuff was hypnosis. You know, I mean, there's different names for it, I guess, but I was training my mind this way, and I'd do it same thing with high performance and tennis. And so I was always just really intrigued with this power of the mind. You know, they say space is the final frontier, and it's not space, it's consciousness, it's your mind and understanding yourself. Because we're way, way more powerful than we give ourselves credit for. I could talk for hours. It's unfortunate that we don't have time for that, but so much cool stuff. I was sharing stuff this morning at a big meeting, at the BNI meeting, you know, 40 people this morning. about how powerful our consciousness is in connecting with people, and the kind of attitude that you have to have to fully expand your consciousness and to make the connections that need to be made and have the experiences that need to be made without falling into these lower hostile emotions all the time. And so as I was learning about that while I was doing real estate and kind of getting, you know, disillusioned with real estate and kind of that concept of like, okay, this is making me money and it's helping me spend time with my kids, but the job itself is not fulfilling to me. So then I was like, well, I've been thinking about hypnotherapy for a couple of years. So I found a good school and learned some methods that at any of the other prestigious schools in the nation for clinical hypnotherapy, they weren't teaching, which I felt really blessed to find, and immediately was having phenomenal success. I never did any marketing right out of the gate. I used those little powers of the mind, the whole law of attraction kind of system that I had, law of attraction on steroids kind of a thing, to make sure I had my 8 clients a week that I was seeing. And, you know, that whole process was fascinating because I was sitting there in clinical hypnotherapy school seeing people no longer need glasses anymore because of an emotional fixation that they had. They fixed it. I had 12 years of irritable bowel syndrome, really bad. And I did 3 little practice sessions while we were in school and knocked that out. I can eat anything I want now without my stomach just rebelling, you know? And that's really awesome to experience and then to see, and then to know how to do it with someone else is just phenomenal.
What has changed in your parenting style, learning these tactics and techniques?
Yeah. So one of the biggest things, is I think I told you, maybe I didn't, but, I have these classes that I give. Sometimes parents are there and I want to do another one for my neighborhood because everyone wants me to put on this class for helping their kids, how to help your kids fix all of their problems and then bring them in. And we don't talk about their kids at all. We just talk about them and how jacked up they are and how they're jacking up their kids. And if you just fix your problems, you'll fix the world around you because kids are just modeling you. Yeah, they have widely varying personalities, but for the most part, they're just modeling you.
Yeah.
They're modeling me.
Modeling, do you mean like a reflection of your emotions and your personality?
Yeah, I'll give you an idea. Like if you walk into the room and your kid is just beside himself, you can't get sucked into what the kid is doing because they're emotionally immature. But an adult will walk in, that kid feels totally powerless, and all they're trying to do is transfer that emotion to you. And so now you feel powerless because you don't know how to help them, and you get sucked into their belief system. You get sucked into their emotion. Well, now it's game over. You're not actually teaching them. You're not the emotionally mature one. And so, you know, you fix yourself, you fix the world around you. One of the things that's really cool that I teach as many parents as I can is that the conscious mind and the subconscious mind are totally different. Conscious mind is associated with, I'll kind of go through this quickly. It's worth a lot of time to think about, but the conscious mind is associated with the frontal lobe. It's critical, it's analytical, it's logical, it's rational, it takes responsibility and accountability for your actions. Kids don't do that. Kids are like, they're like dogs. You know, when you're trying to train a dog, it's all emotional cues, mm-hmm. right? All they have is this emotional memory. And when they're in stress, they don't learn. You got to get them into a space where they're, you know, they're calm again. Now they can learn, right? But they're always wearing their emotions on their sleeves. Meaning they're not using their conscious mind. This frontal lobe is literally not developed for them until around 7 to 11 years old. So, you know, that whole age of accountability thing kind of starts to make sense. But if they're just living from the subconscious mind, the research here shows that, the neuroscience shows that, the beta brainwave state that's associated with the frontal lobe is a state that a child is never in. Meaning any stimulus that they receive is not being filtered through a critical analytical belief system mechanism process. Meaning it's just going straight into the subconscious mind, triggering their imaginations, their memories, their emotions, and then creating a belief system that's deep down there. You just recorded a program inside their mind anytime you gave them a stimulus. Until they get old enough, around 7 years old, if you don't tell a kid, for example, that Santa Claus isn't real, around 7 years old, they start to put the pieces together. Oh, this is the same wrapping that mom has. What the heck? and they're starting to believe something different. And they're willing to say it too. They're mm-hmm. willing to kind of say, oh, well, that doesn't make sense, mom. They question you. Yeah, they question you when they're kids, but that's like to learn. At seven, they're questioning because they wonder if you really know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Right. And so the reason that's important is because there's two reasons. A parent will always mess up their kid if for no other reason than they didn't know how to parent properly. And during those formative years, it was given to the kid and it messed up the kid. But another thing here is that, you know, I've had people that come in and maybe somebody who comes in, they're overweight, they want to lose weight. And we do an age regression, and it turns out when they were 2 years old, sitting in the car seat behind their mom who was driving, the mom said that the kid was chubby. And at 2 years old, they understood that. In fact, they'll understand
it. So they file that away and it's programmed.
Now it's a program, depending on how they reacted to it. Yeah, because mm-hmm. every kid will react a little bit differently. But that'll happen all the way down into the last 3 months of gestation. So even when a kid is, you know, you've got a brand new baby, a week old, it is so important that you do not ever say anything in their presence that could be negative. And you think that they're not listening. You think that they're not paying attention. You think that even if you said something that only an adult would understand, they won't understand it, but their subconscious understands it. Every single time, it may not understand what you meant by it, your intention, but it'll take it and try and create meaning out of it. And now it creates a program.
Yeah.
And that's how we really can mess up our kids. I have a kid that's coming to me that's been in a treatment facility for 8 months for suicide and sexual stuff that he got involved in. And he came in and started doing these sessions about how his father had neglected him when he was 2 or 3 years old. And he really needed that relationship with his father. And I talked to his mom later, and she's like, the last thing that I want to hear is that it's our fault. My husband can't apologize enough to this kid that he neglected him, but like we've done everything that we possibly can. It's like, it was too late. It was too late. Cause when he was a kid, he got programmed that way. You did something to him that was traumatic, and you can say, I'll just buck up and be an adult, but he wasn't an adult at the time. He couldn't do that. And that's why we've got to bring him in for hypnotherapy and teach him how to be an adult, respond ably, responsibly, emotionally, maturely, now understanding the situation better now that he's older, wiser, more mature. And so that's the initiation process, right? Constantly trying to find those things that were holding you back, killing them off, and finding the new identity.
So I have looked into this stuff a little bit. I'm very curious about it. And I've read some stuff about how detrimental technology can be in the first 7 years. We call them the iPad kids. You know, they whine, they cry, here's an iPad. How dangerous is that from your perspective?
Yeah, there's a lot of research on screen time. Part of the problem is that it creates kids who are distracted. And as soon as they feel like they're bored, now they can't be creative anymore. They got to fall back on this thing that's creative for them and to stimulate their imagination. It's part of the reason why the way we grew up, being able to roam the hills, was so good.
Yeah.
Because now the surveys are showing that about 60% of boys in elementary schools have ADHD.
That's high.
Well, there are some interesting things to learn about that.
Yeah.
Because if it's 60%, is it a disability or is it just normal?
Mm-hmm.
There are factors that play into it. Like maybe the kid's just constipated. He's eating so much cheese and pizza, the most constipating foods on the planet. That messes with him. You know, it backs up not just toxins, it backs up emotional toxins too. And maybe he's just not getting enough sleep. Maybe he's on the screens too much. But the reality is, if you have a teacher that's sitting there for 8 hours trying to teach this kid and they're boring as all get out, they're going to kick the desk. They're supposed to be out roaming around.
Yeah. Jordan Peterson talks about this.
Yeah. Same kind of stuff. And the further east you go with more strict and more intense schooling, the more cases of ADHD you actually have. And a lot of people come into me for ADHD and it's like, well, yeah, no kidding. When you were a kid, we always go back to find out when it all started. And for most people, and you can fix the ADHD thing, you know, disorders or just learning disabilities, you can fix all of that. You can fix it almost 100% of the time. From my standpoint, if it's a psychosomatic thing, not a brain injury or something. But we go back and we find out that these kids almost exclusively go back to a time when maybe they were, I had another one just this week, where did this confusion and distraction all start for you? This feeling that you get every time you try and focus, this brain fog thing. Oh, well, it went back to when I was just starting to do this homework and I didn't want to do the homework. I wanted to be outside playing, riding my bike. And that's all it is. It just takes giving the mind two options and then not deciding on them, because you can't decide on them. I don't want to do the homework, but I can't be out there, which means I can't make a decision, and you get stuck. And that creates a pretty strong program in the subconscious mind that every single time you're doing something you don't want to do, you'd rather be somewhere else, you're going to fail because now you can't focus anymore. And so we reestablish what that actually looks like, and we train the younger version of them to learn how to focus, reestablish what it feels like to make a decision. Because if you do your homework faster, you'll get out there to be able to play faster. But that means you got to put out playing out of your mind and focus on this one thing, right? But yeah, messing up the kids, screen time will lend towards that. Diet will lend towards that. Even just friends. So like, you know, me and my wife, we homeschool. And one of the things that I say is that I don't want my kids to go be raised by other kids.
Yeah.
They go to school and that's what happens. It's not possible for the adult to raise them because that adult's trying to raise 30 kids at a time in a classroom. It just isn't possible. And that's important in the formative years because those are the years where you want them to really connect with family as their best friends. You establish the family culture. You teach and ingrain in them, in the family culture, the principles that are what is right, what is wrong, what is true, what is false, what is good, what is bad. This is what we believe as a family. And this is a foundation that we have to give you so that when you get out in the world, you have something to measure it by. But there are a lot of parents now that are like, oh, well, we'll just let our kid believe whatever the heck they want because, yeah, you know, we're liberal, we're open-minded, we're whatever. But you're not establishing a foundation for them. So teach them something and be firm in that so that they know what it looks like for somebody to be firm and stand on their position, you know, without backing down. But
so what are three things that parents can do right now, they can change right now, that will help them and help their kids?
I would say the first thing is look at what the kids are doing and then look at how you're doing that and stop doing it. That's the first thing I would say. Because those kids, they're just going to model you. And whatever you can do to create an environment of them being able to express themselves and feel safe expressing themselves, that's super important because there are a lot of kids. You know, I had a guy that came in, for example, I had all kinds of jaw problems. And this happens a lot. I've seen it with a lot of TMJ issues. He'd had all this dental work done to try and fix all of his jaw problems. And because he'd get all anxious and he was clenching and grinding a lot at night. And it all went back to when his dad and mom were screaming at him, telling him to just be quiet. Just shut your mouth. Just shut your mouth. Be quiet. Stop talking. When he obviously was having an emotional outburst. And you think what you're doing is a good thing, but kids need to have an outlet to be able to express whatever it is they're saying. Because otherwise, you know, a lot of they'll end up with this pent up energy, and that's where it goes. Subconsciously, they got to shut their mouth, so now they're going to grind and have jaw problems, maybe the rest of their life sometimes. And so you can really create problems by inadvertently thinking that the kid is the problem. When the kid is having an emotional outburst, immediately think about what you're doing to create that. The other thing that I would recommend is something that we've had to learn how to do is make it very clear what your family constitution is, what you stand for, what your culture is, maybe what your, you know, there's usually like a pillar in the house, back to the hut thing, right? There was always a, they'd bring in like a pole to hold up the roof, but that was symbolic of either a person with their spinal column being strong and standing up, or, you know, the pillar on top of these, the steeples on top of churches or on temples and stuff like that, always pointing up. There's always something in the household, in the constitution, that points them inward and upward, something that is teaching them that there's more than just the us here and the world out there. There's a lot more to this. Part of that constitution, needs to be very well enforced in the family, because if you're not the one that's going to maintain order, then you'll always be in chaos, and chaos is going to be inevitable. And a lot of parents need to accept that their kids are going to be chaotic, because you move from order to chaos, but then you'll move back into reorder, and that's a leveled up form of reorder. And then you'll move back into chaos, and then you'll move back into reorder again. You reorder things, but you got to have a house of order that is established on some sort of pillars of principles. And that's one thing that we do with our constitution is we, you know, I just have it on the, there's a list of Whiting Family Constitution. We have eight or nine things. They're not rules. They're principles. We love one another. We understand that being kind takes work. We have a growth mindset, meaning it's learning is hard and it takes struggle, but that's how we grow. And that's what this life is all about. You know, we're charitable and that kind of stuff. That now, if they violate one of those, you can just point out what it is, and they're not rules. Oh, the principle, the overarching principle is this. If we teach you true principles, then you can go, you know, make all the mistakes that you want, but you know what the overarching principle is. And then you're not micromanaging with all these rules, you know?
Yeah. Number three.
Number three.
Unless there's only two, that's okay.
Okay. Now, number three, just, you know, on a very personal note, what I do, because I am very often convicted at how difficult it is to be a good father. First off, avoid perfectionism, because perfectionism is never satisfied, and you got to give yourself credit for every little win that you have. And, you know, your best is good enough. But always be trying to improve. But the thing that I would definitely recommend is, and this is just the personal practice, is I get up in the morning and I pray. And when I say I pray, I go that inward, upward, you know, I do my little process in the morning. But one of the main objectives that I have every single morning when I do that is to create within myself a fixed determination to be kind, to be gentle, to understand that my only tools are kindness and gentleness and patience and peacemaking and peaceful persuasion. Because any other way of doing it is going to teach them something that I don't want them to learn. And so there are better ways, but the problem with those ways is that, for example, somebody who is angry is always going to try and justify themselves in being angry because, well, if I don't yell at them, they won't listen to me. So I have to be angry. Well, that's just not true. That's the lie that you got stuck in, right? This keeps you stuck right there getting angry. The reality is love is enough, but it's not going to happen right now. To have the fixed determination to be kind no matter what, that charity, that love, it's going to take maybe years before that kid comes around or your spouse comes around. And you just have to be patient with that because, you know, this isn't a sprint. It's an endurance run. And if you do it wrong, you can create more problems.
Talk to me about an unexpected trial that you've experienced in fatherhood that you may not have experienced otherwise.
Well, maybe I won't talk about that one. Here was the big unexpected trial. My daughter that was born with cerebral palsy, right? She's born and we think she's totally normal. And for 6 months, she seems totally normal, but she's a little delayed, you know? And then she starts having all these seizures. We don't know what they are. They're called infantile spasms. They kind of just crunch up, you know? And we didn't know what they were. And then at 8 months, they were getting pretty rough. We took her into primary children's after going to all these specialists, didn't know what was going on. And she was having like 24 seizures a day.
Wow.
And so we do the MRI. And man, when that thing showed up on the screen, you know, that was traumatic for me and my wife to see half of my daughter's brain missing. Well, half of her left brain and a portion of her right brain, totally gone, filled up with cerebral spinal fluid because the medial cerebral artery had been taken out in two strokes that she had in the womb. We had no idea. And they found out that it was, you know, because they're sciencey and they know how to read that stuff, but they knew that it had happened in the womb. We had no idea. And that has made it so, you know, she's 4 years old now. And, you know, she still can't communicate basically at all without just screaming. She can't even form words. She doesn't do any of the baby babble stuff. She's almost totally immobile, all locked up in this one hand. She can do some stuff with, but almost nothing. Doesn't eat well, can't sit up or stand or roll over even on her own, any of that kind of stuff. And so that's been hard because, you know, we have three kids and we wanted to have like six or seven, you know, and every time we're thinking of doing that, it's like something else happens with her where we're reminded how difficult it is to have a disabled child, mm-hmm. like fully disabled child that everyone says is going to be permanently disabled, you know? And so we don't know what's going to happen with her, but we just know it's just our job to love. And I think it's really cool when you see other people now in these families that have disabled kids, because like our two boys, Jesse and Leo, they've learned how to be empathetic and to help and care for and sacrifice what they need, knowing that she has a need that is going to be met before them, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that's really good for little kids to learn. So it's been a super blessing. We're really lucky because she's not like out of control temper tantrums all the time. In fact, one of the doctors said that he believed that she had what's called CASC gene disorder, a genetic mutation. And the mutation is, well, it results in just being happy all the time. Super bright-eyed and happy all the time.
Interesting.
And so, and she is, she has that almost all the time. Except when she wants something or the TV show isn't exactly what she wants. But yeah, that's been an unexpected trial as a father that, takes, I don't know what it is. It's just a piece of, you doing everything you can to not fall into this sense of powerlessness because you want to fix that so bad. You're like, I'll just leave it to the higher power to figure out what we need to do here in this little family now. So
when you received that news, was there a moment of darkness? And if so, how did you break out of that? Or had life already prepared you to just attack this and be able to handle it properly?
You know what's interesting? I had just gotten into the hypnotherapy thing, and one of the things that I had learned was when stuff like if you found out that somebody died or you find out somebody has cancer or something like this, your daughter's totally disabled, it can be such a hit to the system that it really derails you and messes you up for a while. And I remember seeing that screen and thinking, this is crazy. And my whole body just like had that shock feeling to it. And there were literally like nine neurosurgeons standing around us all looking at it. Cause there are all these students and then these higher up doctors. And we're like the dumb ones looking at the screen. Like, what are we looking at right here? And my wife took it really hard, really hard. Cause we spent the next 2 days in the hospital and all these tests being done. And Lacey and I, It was hard for both of us. I felt like she took it really hard. Just the sadness that hit,
yeah.
You know, cause it's that expectation. She's our only daughter. And it's that expectation like, oh, well, I'm not going to have the daughter girl connection like most people have. And maybe even the marriage and the grandkids and all that from her. It was just that projection in the future, like, oh, all these things that you're not going to have now from this child that, well, what just happened, you know? So there was definitely a shock there. I didn't think that I fell into the sadness until 3 years later and I'm having these, like, I can't sleep at night and I'm getting really angry and upset because I'm so sleep deprived and I get angry and upset and then I get sad because I feel powerless to be able to fix the situation. And I had to have my other hypnotherapist that I hired that works for me. With me, I called him. I was like, I need you to come over and work on me. He came over and we were trying to figure out where all this anger was coming from. And anger is a cover emotion. It's cover emotion for hurt, for grief, for sadness, for fear. And I did not know this, but as soon as he put me down and was trying to figure out where all this anger was coming from, I immediately was put back in the hospital looking at that screen. And I just broke down crying, which did not happen at all. Never had happened. Didn't happen in the hospital. Didn't happen in the subsequent years. It only happened when he put me down and I finally connected with that emotion and realized the trauma that that really put on me that I hadn't processed. It was like, maybe I hadn't been willing to look at it because I was trying to be strong for the family, you know, but, I had to come to terms with that. And I did. And then I started sleeping again and I was fine. I didn't have the anger outburst kind of feelings in the middle of the night like I had been having before.
I'm going to throw some rapid fire questions at you about hypnotherapy.
Okay.
So give me short, quick answers. Okay. Who could use it?
Everyone is always a bad answer, but it's everyone. Anyone that has a mental and emotional issue, and that's anyone who feels stuck. You know, it's easy to think, what are the things that I feel like I'm fighting against myself on, where part of me wants something, but the other part of me doesn't seem to want it, or I have to convince myself that, you know, that other thing needs to get on the same page with me. That's conscious and subconscious mind fighting against each other. Anyone that has that, it's a very common occurrence. Everyone has it. And that's the kind of thing that hypnotherapy helps with, removing that.
How many sessions on average does someone need?
In traditional therapy, it takes, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 sessions, sometimes 100 sessions, because on average it's 1 to 3 years, according to the National Institute of Psychology or whatever. In hypnotherapy, we have, in my office, I've proven this out at about a 95% recovery rate. 95% of my people recover in 1 to 3 sessions.
Okay.
They're totally done with the problem. And I can spend additional sessions doing trainings on them. But
how long is a session?
60 to 75 minutes. Unless there's more layers to it, then it might be up to 2 hours.
Okay. So if somebody is in need of your services, how do they find you?
Yeah, my business is No Limits Hypnotherapy, www.nolimitshypnotherapy. I just submitted a book to the publisher that's coming out. It's called Pornography is Not Your Problem. I wrote the whole book in the title and I just mistitled it. It's Your Problem Isn't Pornography. There's a reason why that's the title. But I just put that out and anyone who wants can get a free copy of it as soon as it's out. They can contact me to pre-order it. You know, around here in, you know, the LDS church estimates about 85% of singles between 18 and 35 are struggling with that. Mm-hmm. In my last ward, it was 100% of the youth, the bishop said, were struggling with a pornography viewing problem. So I took that upon myself to be a specialty and people can access that through the website or contacting me.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. Just to wrap this up, I ask the same question to all my guests at the end, and that is, if there's one lesson you want to leave with your children when you're no longer here, what is that lesson?
Honor God. If you do that, you'll be okay. And if you obtain forgiveness, then you have every reason in the world to rejoice.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts and stories and experiences. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Jace. You're cool. The man.
Thanks.
Okay.